The people will, Richard says, rape you, beat you up, kill you. After that, she always had the paranoia. When you don't have a home, you're paranoid. She had no education. She had no school. About life on the beach, he says, think about it. That's hard. You can't go to Burger King to go to work. You got a prostitute. She probably became a child prostitute at this point, like Billie Holiday, and tried to snort and shoot the pain away. Marcia needed protection. The only people she met who offered it were the Hell's Angels, the drug-dealing motorbike gang who couriered coke across the highways of America. Richard thought they used her to transport drugs because a pretty young white girl doesn't attract much attention, so she became a house mouse, one of the women who travels with them and skivvies for them, cleaning their bikes and their homes. A female friend of Richard's, who came along to the interview, said that in that life, you're a slave. You're nothing when you're a biker chick. And once you get in, it's kind of a mafia deal. Once you get in, you may as well leave the country and hide because they will kill you. They will kill you because you know too much. So what was in it for Marcia to be a house mouse? Richard says, safe place to eat, and food, and drugs, place to shower. Ain't got to worry about people kicking in the door because there's a guy with a gun at the door. Marcia's man in the Angels was a much older guy called Conrad Kurz, who was kind of strict to her. He was a Nazi, a full-fledged Nazi. His home was filled with swastikas and Hitlerian flags. He kept a pretty good leash on her, Richard says, until they had a baby girl, Eureka, and the baby was taken away by the authorities in Arizona, presumably because Marcia had developed a drug addiction. Conrad couldn't take the loss of his child. One day he shot himself in the head in the shower. Richard met her when he pulled up on his motorcycle at a truck stop when they were both in their early 30s. He, too, is an angel.
That's why she stopped me, because I had the fastest bike in town. She liked to go fast, he says.
He immediately liked her. She cooked him pork chops, and he loved the way she even made a fully cooked breakfast, egg and sausages, for his dog. They went gold panning. They rode up to the lakes to look for chunks of gold.
We do that for weekends at a time, he says.
Marcia loved being outside, in the water. It was where she was happiest. They decided to settle down in Missouri.
I worked the railroad for a year. We had a house, had a car, he says.
He managed to get Marcia to give up all drugs except weed. She started to do normal things. She mowed the lawn. She watched TV. She planted flowers. She started to draw flowers, too.
She was so happy to be stable, he says. I always got her stable.
But she decided she wanted to go back to Arizona for her daughter, Eureka. She couldn't just leave her out there without her mother. When Marcia got back to Arizona, she discovered she had an outstanding warrant for having 1.5 grams of marijuana, two joints. The police busted her, and she received her first conviction and was sentenced to a year under house arrest. When he looks back over her life, Richard believes this was the turning point, when her stability was pulled down again. She'd been okay for a year, but now, after her arrest, Marcia's paranoia returned with a vengeance. One day, when it was extremely hot out, she flew into a terror and ran down the street barefoot, and she got third-degree burns on her soles. They had to take skin from her back to graft in its place. As he said this, I found myself thinking of the last time Billie Holiday got clean, and George White came to stalk her because of her past. Marcia and Richard had a son together, Richie. She relapsed after the arrest and kept getting arrested now. Richard says it should have been clear to the authorities that she was an addict. Addiction can be overcome with proper help. It ain't a jail thing. He believes the solution was to get her into a mental hospital. That's probably what would have helped her. Get her whatever she needs. Xanax, morphine, to get her chemical imbalance right. Get her on the right meds. Show her some respect. Give her some working skills. Get her a GED so when she comes out she has a place, like a woman's shelter, and get a job. Give her respect. That's how it's supposed to be. He believes, if you're calm and cool, and know you've got a life ahead of you that's going up the steps, if you know you're going up in the world, you're going to stay going up in the world. Instead, she kept being kicked down the steps by the criminal justice system. One day she disappeared into a police car, and he never saw her again. Richard eventually got together with another woman and took Richie back to live with her and her kids in Missouri, where the boy would often ask about his mother. Then one day, 10 years later, Richard came home to find the house on fire. He only found out later what happened. His stepson had raped and murdered Richie and his entire family, and burned down their home. He tells me about this in broken fragments, as if it's too painful to explain clearly. He pushes in front of me newspaper reports of the deaths, which have the same baffled tone. He says the kid just went crazy one day and murdered them all. Richard doesn't know whether Marcia ever found out that her son had died. She had another year to live. He hopes she didn't. In the arrest reports for Marcia Powell, you can hear her voice. In 1996, she gave a blowjob to a man in an alleyway in Phoenix, and a passing 13-year-old boy happened to get a glimpse of it. The police charged her with sexual indecency to a minor, a charge normally leveled against pedophiles. The police wrote down her babble in a tone that sounds mocking. She said she had been asked to give a blowjob to a man, but life would not permit it. We couldn't do it because of a jolt, which is a life we conquered. She then offered to have sex with the officers arresting her because there was a nationwide emergency. John's in trouble. Visa. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Special Forces, National Guard. But then suddenly, she was sane again, and sad. The report says she argued, she is not really a bad person, did not hurt the kid or anything, and is not a menace to society because she loves people, is teaching love while in jail, and is not a total waste of time. Richard looks at these reports when I hand them to him, and reads for a moment. Then he says simply, I'll miss her. In prison, looking out across the desert, Marcia would talk dreamily about nature. She was a pagan in her beliefs. She believed that the trees had the same DNA we did. One of her former cellmates, Juliana Phillips, tells me. Marcia would say that everything out there has a soul and is our brother. We contaminate the water. People can't drink the water. We can drink bottled water, but our squirrels and cows and dogs and cats and buffalo can't drink that. They still have to be poisoned. Later, Rich tells me, if Arizona hadn't stuck her in jail for 1.5 grams of usable marijuana, we'd be in Illinois living high. That is, well, I'd be 20 years with the railroad. We had a nice house there, huge yard. She'd be a mom, kids raised. Richie would have been 18 now. My kids might still be alive. Just because of a little bullshit. Perhaps this is only a comforting myth he uses to deal with his pain, since Marcia had such deep-seated problems, but perhaps it is true. Perhaps that conviction did kick her out of the only trough of stability she ever found. For Richard, it seems to hurt most that, as she lay dying,
they're making fun of her for being ill.
Richard hands me a photograph of Richie, and asks if I can arrange for it to be put with Marcia's grave,
so she knows she wasn't a criminal.
Because, he says, she made angels. Many of the prison guards who put Marcia Powell in an exposed cage in the desert and ignored her screams are still at work today. Chapter 9. Bart Simpson and the Angel of Juarez. An 8-foot-tall angel stood on the sidewalk in Ciudad Juarez, with his vast feathery wings bristling in the breeze and his silver skin glistening in the light, as he stared down at yet another corpse. It was, a 20-year-old man. He'd been walking on the street next to his house in this city, the most dangerous in the world, when the gunmen arrived. The angel could see the bullet wounds and the puddle of blood, and the weeping when two of his relatives arrived. The angel was carrying a sign. It was addressed to the murderers, the people who had massacred more than 60,000 people like this in Mexico in just 5 years. It addressed them by name. Chapo Guzman, the drug lord. The Zetas, the craziest of his rivals. The police, the army. Time is short, the sign said. Seek forgiveness. Juan Manuel Alguin grew up in Ciudad Juarez, the Mexican city that sits across the border from the Texan city of El Paso, as the drug war was turning it into the deadliest place on the planet. I met him sometime after he had stood over that corpse on a Thursday night in 2012, in Juarez, when he was wearing his wings. I'd been reading the figures on Mexico's drug war for years, but they didn't make much sense to me. I knew the best estimate was, I'll repeat the number, that 60,000 people had been killed in 5 years, that 90% of the cocaine used in the United States passed through here every year, that Mexican drug cartels make between $19 and $29 billion every year from U.S. drug sales alone. But the human stories I heard were so extreme, I couldn't make any connection with them. They seemed to all focus on such unimaginable sadism. Beheadings posted on YouTube, or pregnant women carved up with bottles, that it seemed unreal. That is why, one morning in July, I walked into Ciudad Juarez from the United States over the thin brown trickle of the Rio Grande. The bridge was backed up with cards and squeegee merchants. Women sat on the ground, begging in two languages. The Mexican border agents didn't check anything I brought in. They waved me through with an unsmiling nod. One of the first things I saw was a sign. Historic Downtown Tour of Juarez, it said, directing me to the sites that were famous when this was one of the great party towns of North America. This is where Billie Holiday came to get hitched and get wasted, and she was only one of millions of Americans who wanted the same Juarez buzz. But that route has, I saw, now been papered over with posters. Have you seen her? The plastered signs say, above images of one young woman or another, smiling at a party in the time before. One of them, in red lipstick and a multicolored scarf, caught my eye. This is all there is to see now in Juarez. The absences. The tourist attractions have all been shuttered or burned down. My fixer, Julian Cardona, the Reuters correspondent for Juarez, drove me around the city as I tried to get a feel for where I was. It soon became clear that if Rothstein's Manhattan was a vertical city reaching for the skies, this is a horizontal city scrambling for the desert. Its city center looks like any North American nowhere town, where a 24-hour Wendy's squats next to a mall, where the theme from Titanic plays in a panpipes version as people buy enormous flat-screen televisions. But as you follow the fat 8-lane highways for miles out of town, the city thins, and the malls turn into burned-out husks of stores and rusty shanty towns. Just when you think you've hit the edge of Juarez, you find another rash of homes and stores before finally the sand dunes win. But before Juarez petered out, I had arranged to meet the Angels. When he was 11, Juan started to watch his friends vanish into the Juarez drug trade. This is the most important smuggling route into the United States, and the gangs were at war to control it. The cartels prefer kids. They don't understand death, so are less afraid. Juan's best friend joined for the cash and the sense that, finally, he was part of something. Juan, in a fog of hormones, considered joining a cartel himself. He would have money, at last. He would be able to support his family, which was sunk in alcoholism and drug addiction. But with people being slaughtered all around him, with houses being burned and shops being abandoned on every corner, he made a different choice. He told me that, at the age of 16, I decided to become an angel. At first, when the murders began, people would run in panic from the death scenes. Then it changed. They started to stop and stare. Then it changed again. They would just walk on by, as if it was normal, as if it was nothing, because in Juarez, it was. People were training themselves not to see, to dismember the part of them that sees the dismembering. But Juan and his teenage friends refused to live in a city where murder was ignored. Even though every adult who spoke out against the cartels, the army, or the police had been killed, he and a group who met at his church decided to go to the murder scenes to protest. They built angel costumes with great 2-meter wings made from plastic and feathers. They covered themselves with sparkling silver paint and stood on a tall stool. The long, shining robes hang down over both their body and the stool, so the angel looks like a giant, as though he has just descended from heaven. It's hard to describe what this looks like. It's almost unreal, like a hallucination. These kids make signs directly challenging the most brutal murderers on earth, and they hold them aloft at the very spot where these men have just done their killing. On the night I met Juan, after a summer storm, he was about to go to stand by another roadside at midnight to hold up his signs. He invited me to come along. Two young girls perched behind him, holding on to his wings so the wind wouldn't blow him backward. People in the cars that hurried past looked astonished and bewildered and frightened. "I am not afraid. If I get killed or whatever happens to me, it's because I'm doing something good for the city," Juan tells me. "I tell my mother to be proud of me if something happens." He and his friends have been betrayed by the generation leading the drug war, he believes. "We want to show them, by example, that we want a better society." Most people in Juarez are amazed the angels have not been shot. They will tell you, wearily, that it's only a matter of time. Arnold Rothstein dreamed of a New York City where the rule of law had been hollowed out, and the only true rulers were criminals like him. He wanted to establish power by force, and buy the remaining broken slivers of the state piece by piece, until he could use them, too, as weapons. He never got to realize his dream. His bullet hit too soon. But his dream did come to pass. I wanted to know what this meant for real people in their real lives. This is the part of the drug war most remote from my world, back in the stability of London. Yet I was beginning to feel we were all enmeshed together, the subjects of the drug war and its logic, in a long, densely connected global chain. The impulse to repress, I suspected, had given birth to all this, but I wanted to see how. I met many people in northern Mexico who shared their stories with me, but in the end, I came to understand what has happened there best through the tale of three teenagers. They were an angel, a killer, and a girl in love. Just as Chino had explained to me what life is like inside a street gang, I wanted to understand what life is like inside a cartel, but I kept being told this was impossible. The cartels kill anyone who talks to outsiders. These are the most paranoid and secretive people in the world. And then, one day, I learned about one person, the only one ever to make it out and keep talking. I wrote to the Texas Prison Service. After a long wait, I was told I had half an hour. Once I arrived in the middle of Tyler County in rural Texas, a huge mess of concrete and barbed wire, a guard smiled at me.
"I like your accent," she said in deep Texan. "You can have as much time as you want."
I was guided through the prison by another guard until I was in a wide gray room and there was only glass in front of me. On the other side of the glass were tiny white cells. The guard said,
"I'm going to be around here in the area because I can't leave you by yourself."
And then she left. At the back of one of the cells, a door opened, and he walked in, small and lithe. He looked like a nerd who should be presenting a science project to me. The only thing undermining his look was his eye tattoo, a bright-colored flame dominating his face.
"So, what's going on?" he said, looking me up and down.
Before I could say anything, he said,
"First of all, what do you know about me? That's what I want to know."
He had a low voice. I said, "I know you are here because from the age of 13 you were a member of the Zetas." He nodded. I asked Rosalio if I could put a little recorder between us. There was a hole in the glass, and the recorder sat there with its red light on. He began to talk. After each piece of information he gave me, he asked nervously what I thought of him and whether I would make him sound good. He was almost pleading. He had been alone for a very long time, in solitary confinement. We talked for over 4 hours. This is his story, as I can patch it together from what he told me and from the other evidence of his crimes in the public record. In 2005, Rosalio Reta was at summer camp, like all the other American teenagers his age. A short, Texan 15-year-old with spiky hair, nicknamed Bart, because he looked like a less yellow Bart Simpson and loved to skateboard. He was also into the Power Rangers, alternative pop, and Nintendo 64, especially The Mask of Zelda and Donkey Kong. At camp in that particular year, he was learning useful skills, ones he would remember for the rest of his life. Except at this camp, you don't learn how to canoe, or sing in a chorus, or make a log fire. He remembered the techniques he learned there well. Take beheading, for example.
"There's times I've seen it, they've done it with a saw," he told me through the prison glass. "Blood everywhere. When they start going, they hit the jugular and," he snaps his fingers, "it's everywhere. They put their head right there. The head still moves, makes faces and everything. I think the nerves you can see inside, the bone, everything's moving. It's like they've got worms. I've seen it move when it's on the ground. If he's making a screaming face, it stays like that sometimes. Sometimes it slacks off."
This camp was deep in the mountains of Mexico, and Rosalio was there for 6 months, slowly being turned into a human weapon.
"They just teach you everything. Everything you learn at the military camp," he says. "How to shoot, how to coordinate,
All kinds of explosives, handguns, rifles, hand-to-hand combat. The camp's slogan is, "If I retreat, kill me." He used these skills to murder more people than he can count. He committed industrial killings, threw hand grenades into crowded nightclubs, and shot a man in front of his toddler son and pregnant wife. A few years before his trip to camp, the United States government, determined to achieve Harry Anslinger's mission of spreading the drug war to every country on Earth, had decided to train an elite force within Mexico to win the war on drugs. The United States brought them to Fort Bragg to provide the best training, intelligence, and military equipment from America's 7th Special Forces Group. Their motto was, "Not even death will stop us." Once it was over, and they had learned all they could and received all the weapons they wanted, these expensively trained men went home and defected en masse to work for the Gulf Cartel. These breakaways called themselves the Zetas. It would be as if the Navy SEALs defected from the U.S. Army to help the Crips take over Los Angeles, and succeeded. Rosalia's hometown, the dusty desert of Laredo in Texas, is right across the border from Nuevo Laredo in Mexico. He tells me, "Every cartel wants that route. It's one of the biggest places of crossing from country to country. It's a big commercial place. So everybody wants it. That's what everybody's fighting for. That I-35. If your cartel controls that interstate highway, you control the flow of billions of dollars. If your enemies control it, they can strip you of your livelihood. That is a recipe for a war." There are two different stories of how Rosalio became a Zeta. There is the story he told when he first talked to the police when he was 16, and then there is the story he told me when he was 23. I have no way of knowing which of these is more accurate, so I have laid them out here for you to judge. We know this much for sure. He grew up in a house made of wood that was propped up on cinder blocks. His mother was a hairdresser. His father was an undocumented immigrant who worked on construction sites. They had 10 children. Laredo is one of the poorest parts of the United States, a border town where, as he has said, "If you're not a cop, you're a drug dealer. If you're not a drug dealer, you work for a cartel. That's all there is down there." He said another time, "A lot of people here, in the United States, want to be an attorney, a lawyer, a judge, a firefighter, a policeman. Over there, on the U.S.-Mexico border, they worship the Zetas. The little kids say, 'I want to be a Zeta when I grow up.' But he insists, 'I wasn't, like, poor, poor, poor. My mom and dad both worked. We had stuff to eat every day. We were normal. We were a family.'" He had two best friends he spent all his time with, Jesse and Gabrielle. They played football, hung out by the lake, played video games. All through his childhood, he skipped back and forth over the border. Sodas and candies are cheaper in Nuevo Laredo, so he would often head there with his friends. And as an adolescent, there are nightclubs that will let you in as young as 13, so he and Jesse and Gabrielle spent more time there. Here's where the story splits for a moment. When Rosalia was first questioned by the police, he had spent 3 years immersed in Zeta life, a world where the culture of terror has been taken to its most extreme variant yet. In the tapes, he looks hyped with this hatred, smirking and strutting and half expecting the cops to be impressed by his boasts of mass murder. He tells them that at 13, he started hanging out at a nightclub in Nuevo Laredo and heard whispers of a man who had it all, Miguel Trevino. He came from nothing to be number two in the Zetas. Like Arnold Rothstein, he was an unassuming, almost anonymous-looking man, 5'8", a teetotaler, drug-free, dressed in blue jeans and Walmart T-shirts. but he was the king of the town. He controlled the drug trade, the military, the police, everything. Rosalio wanted what he had. He met him and offered to prove his loyalty, whatever it took. Then there's a different story about how it all started. He told me his friend had an older brother who worked for the cartels, and one day they went to eat in Nuevo Laredo. The brother received a call and said he had to go to deal with some business, so Rosalio hid himself in the back of his truck. He was curious. He wanted to know what it looked like. When they arrived, he discovered he was at one of the ranches used by Miguel Trevino to carry out his business. And he saw too much. Here's where the stories converge again. In both versions, the ranch was a typical Zeta workspace. There were about 30 people tied up. On one side, they put them in an oil drum, and they just burn them, and there's just ashes left. On the other side, they were being cut to pieces. The Zetas usually torture members of other gangs, or anyone who irks them, to find out safe houses, routes, who they work for, about what they do, who they are working for, what is he doing, before the killing starts. After they are dead, they burn the bodies by making guiso, the Spanish word for stew. Throw him in there and poke at the body until it dissolves. This is where Rosalio carried out his first killing. I didn't look at him in the face, he says. He was tied up. He was kneeling down, tied up behind his back and his feet. They were all crying, begging, saying, "Don't kill me." Everybody. Some of them weren't even saying anything. They knew they were going to get killed. Everyone was there to be killed. He took the gun and shot the man in the head. He would never find out who he was. The first Rosalio, emerging blinking from the Zeta light, told the cops he loved this experience. "I thought I was Superman. I loved doing it, killing that first person. They tried to take the gun away, but it was like taking candy from a kid." He said from then on, "There were others to do it, but I would volunteer. It was like a James Bond game. Everyone can do it, but not everyone wants to. Some are weak in the mind and cannot carry it in their conscience. Others sleep as peacefully as fish." He added, "I like what I do. I don't deny it." The second Rosalio, in the monochrome of the Texas prison system, says this was crazed babble, offered up in a moment of mania. "Because after a long while I was safe. I was alive. I actually made it from Mexico alive. And the majority of everybody around me is dead. Everybody I really cared for, that I grew up with, is dead already. I was alive. I made it alive. And having been this close to being killed..." No, he says, he didn't enjoy it. He started killing on that day because he realized that once he had seen the ranch, they wouldn't let him walk away as a witness. He had to either die or become a participant. From that moment on, you're forced to do what they want. You have to do it, whether you want it or not. You're forced to do it. If you don't do it, they kill you. It's just plain and simple. You kill, or you get killed. And that's it. That bullet made him a Zeta and blocked all the exits. "Whether you go in willingly or forcibly," he says, "once you're in. It's a done deal. And whether I like it or not, these people molded me into one of their soldiers, doing their deeds." That account was confirmed, years later, by the U.S. police investigation. Rosalio is a very rare example of somebody who peers into the heart of the Mexican drug cartels and makes it out alive. For 3 years, he was working directly for Miguel Trevino. For long stretches, he was one of the paramilitary posse living with them in safe houses, by his side, killing on his orders. Trevino and his fellow Zetas refer to kids like Rosalio and Jesse and Gabriel by a name. The Expendables. It happened so quick since that first day. From there, everything went... Rosalio makes a pfft sound. That's when I knew I had stepped over the border already. I was in a different world. He didn't tell his parents because he was convinced if he did, they would be killed. He didn't tell anyone. When I met him, he wouldn't even say Trevino's name for a long time. He tells me, "It's better you don't even talk about him." He repeats it, "It's better if you don't even talk about him. He don't have any limits. That's why a lot of people don't even talk about him, especially in Mexico. They're afraid of even saying his name over there." But haltingly, in fragments, he painted a picture of a man who, like Rothstein, thought only of money and would do anything to get it. While the violence was more extreme, it followed the same logic demanded by Prohibition. He captured the market by violence and maintained it by terror. His killing was never random, even as it was psychotic. It was all geared, Rosalio explained, toward intimidation for the rival cartels, trying to behead them on videos so they can know they mean business, that they ain't playing around. He was absorbing the same rules Chino learned on his block, cast onto a more extreme canvas. You have to be so terrifying nobody will ever try to fuck with you. For Brownsville teenagers, that means whipping and shooting. For Nuevo Laredo teenagers, that means beheading and burning. Rosalia was ordered to embark on a string of targeted killings, of rival cartels, and of anyone who got in the Zeta's way. From day to day, you never know what they're going to do. They might want to torture somebody to death today, or they might drown him today, they might hang him today, or they're going to cut him to pieces and burn him alive. You never know what they're going to do. It depends what they feel like doing. He added, everything was always the same. They killed people on a daily basis. There's not a day that goes by that they don't kill someone, that they don't torture someone, that they don't burn someone alive. That's your daily routine. That's what they do for a living. When he was sent to kill a person, I don't know the person who was in front of me. I don't know what they had done. Anything. He just knew to make sure they died. The cartels send messages written in human flesh. They have a system of signals known to everyone. If you betray the cartel, they'll shoot you in the neck. If you talk too much, they'll shoot you in the mouth. But if you are a spy, they'll shoot you in the ear. Each body is a billboard, advertising that your cartel is the most vicious. His friends, Jesse and Gabriel, started to work with him for the Zetas. He won't say how this started, but the police investigation, and their subsequent fates, confirm their involvement is real. Did he introduce them? Did he bring them in? It's not clear. But it was becoming obvious to everyone that, as he said, it's not a game anymore. We have to stay up a lot of the time, sometimes a week and a half, he explained, almost 2 weeks, no sleep, and everybody used to do cocaine, so they used to give us that. We had to go from one place to another, so we couldn't sleep. At some point, Gabriel had eyeballs tattooed on his eyelids, so it looked as if he was always awake, always watching. Which you had to be if you wanted to be safe. In the house with Trevino, there's a lot of people they have taking care of the place, lookouts and everything. They see some rivals or anything, they call all groups to a shootout. Everybody was afraid of everybody else. After a while, I couldn't trust them, he says. I just stay to myself.
You never know if one of them might try to kill you from the back. I've seen it happen so many times. It's a lot of people over there when you're working for them. If somebody doesn't like you, you are at the wrong place. They sneak up on you and kill you. The same people you're working with. Everybody knew. All Trevino has to say is, he snaps his fingers, kill him. That's all he has to do. Just give the order and I'm gone. He called his mother every now and then to let her know he was still alive. He didn't tell her what he was doing. The worst nightmares aren't where you are killed. They are where you are a killer. In the midst of the terror, there were treats. They were throwing around money, everything you wanted, everything. Trevino held raffles. He'd put everyone's name in a cup, and the winner, Rosalio, got a brand new Mercedes. There were girls whenever you wanted them, and coke. Rosalio was paid $500 a week as a retainer, and much more for big hits. $375,000 for killing one of Chapo Guzman's associates at the age of 15. Forgetting his story about being forced from the start for a moment, Rosalio told me that when the treats began, you didn't have to do anything then and there, but once they lured you in, it was a trap. Then he seemed to realize what he had said and added quickly that he was talking about his friends, but not himself. He was forced, he insists. He was forced. Sometimes they lived in a fancy safe house back over the border in Laredo. Gabriel spent all his time there with his girlfriend. Rosalio and Jesse would ride around their old neighborhoods and play by the lake, as they used to. Why, I asked Rosalio, did the cartels use American teenagers and not Mexicans? Because of the easy access to both sides of the border, he says. But what's the advantage to that if they're killing people in Mexico? What would you do in the United States for them? I don't want to talk about that. There's a lot of things I'd just rather not talk about. Later, as I listened again and again to the recording of this interview, I found myself returning to the work of Philippe Bourgois, the French sociologist whose writing helped me understand Chino's story. Under Prohibition, he explains, if you are the first to abandon a moral restraint, you gain a competitive advantage over your rivals and get to control more of the drug market. So the expendables are sent to butcher not just rival cartel members, but their relatives. On a wiretap, a conversation between Rosalio and Gabriel was recorded. Gabriel described kidnapping two teenagers who were the cousins of a rival. They died on their own from the beating, he said. They just died, and they just died and shit. You should have been there. You should have seen Pancho, dude. He was crying like a faggot. No, man, I'm your friend. What friend, you son of a bitch? Shut your mouth. And boom! I grabbed the fucking bottle and slash. I slid his whole fucking belly. And boom, he was bleeding. I grabbed the little cup and boom, the little cup. Boom, boom. I filled it with blood and boom. And then I went to the other faggot and slash. I slid him with the same thing. Rosalio laughed. The local cops disposed of the bodies for Gabriel. He said later, I've killed men while they were tied and bound, but there's no thrill, no excitement in that for me. I prefer to stalk my targets, hunt them down, and then, after I know their moves, front to back, I sneak up on them, look them in the eyes, and pull the trigger. Now that's a rush. If you are the first to kill your rival's relatives, including their pregnant women, you get a brief competitive advantage. People are more scared of your cartel, and they will cede more of the drug market to you. Then, every cartel does it. It becomes part of standard practice. If you are the first to behead people, you get a brief competitive advantage. Then, every cartel does it. If you are the first to behead people on camera and post it on YouTube, you get a brief competitive advantage. Then, every cartel does it.
If you're the first to mount people's heads on pikes and display them in public, you gain a brief competitive advantage. Then every cartel does it. If you are the first to behead a person, cut off his face, and sew it onto a soccer ball, you get a brief competitive advantage, and on it goes. Prohibition, Bourgeois explains in his writing, creates a system in which the most insane and sadistic violence has a sane and functional logic. It is required. It is rewarded. In the midst of all this killing, Rosalio and his friends were never once worried about the police or being caught. Why? Rosalio started to notice something strange about Trevino from the first day he worked for him. Carolyn Rothstein said that her husband, Arnold, would often argue that
probably the best job in public life for which he was fitted was that of police commissioner of New York.
Trevino has achieved it. Wherever they went in Mexico, Rosalio observed that the police worked for Trevino. There's no police now. Everything was under his control. Military, police, everything. He bribed them. He drove everywhere with $2 million in cash, in case any impromptu payments were necessary. And where that didn't work, they know if they mess something up, like a drug smuggling route, they're going to get killed. So they just stay out of the way. Indeed, sometimes the police escort you to do an assassination. The same police kidnaps a person and takes them to the cartel. Trevino's associates went right to the top of the Mexican state. They might be working for the president by day, and by night they're working for the cartels. Why have these drug gangs been able to capture Mexico when drug gangs in the United States can't? As I tried to understand this, I started to picture prohibited drugs as a river being redirected to wash across a town. If a river washes into a skyscraper, it might erode the walls and break some windows. But if it washes into a wooden house, it will wash it away entirely. In Mexico, the foundations of law and democracy are made of wood. It was governed by one semi-dictatorial party for 7 decades until 2000, so a culture of feeling that the law is something citizens write together and should be obeyed together has not yet properly developed. And the river is flowing much faster, and it is carrying much more water relative to its surroundings. In Juarez, it is believed that 60 to 70% of the economy runs on laundered drug money, while drug money represents a vastly smaller fraction of the U.S. economy. Nothing can withstand this force. Rosalio was in the woods. He could see that, even though he couldn't see much else. One eye was swollen shut. He could only see a little through the swelling in the other. And his throat was bleeding. Trevino's men had tried to slice it open. They cut him up all over. He will have the scars from this attack covering his body for the rest of his life. So Rosalia was running. There are once again 2 stories about how Rosalio got here, to these woods and his throat cutting. The first story, advanced by the U.S. television documentary Nothing Personal, is that after training him to be a killer, the cartels lost control of him. He was running off Trevino's leash and killing freelance. They sent him to kill a cartel rival in Monterrey, and instead he threw a grenade into a nightclub, killing 4 people and wounding 24. The cartel's sadism is unimaginably vicious, but it always has a purpose. If you simply go Jeffrey Dahmer on them, you are spraying your sadism randomly, instead of focusing it where they tell you to. That's a distraction they don't need and won't tolerate. The second story was offered by Rosalio himself. After 3 years, I couldn't keep on living with these people, telling me what to do, who to kill, where to go, how to sleep, how to go about myself. I can't live my whole life like that.
I can't live in fear of them saying people will be killing me. I had to stop it one way or another.
In the past, he had seen people get shot by rival gangs and then put out to pasture, allowed out of the life. So, he said, in that moment of desperation, he decided, at the age of 16, to shoot himself. He pulled up his trouser leg and showed me the wound. It was large and angry. Some of the nerves were destroyed. He can't feel much there. After pulling the trigger, he said, he shot himself with Novocaine and cleaned the wound up with the skills he had learned at the training camp. I was missing a big old chunk of meat, so I had somebody help me close it, and I sewed it up the best I could. I cleaned it, took some antibiotics. On the first day, he didn't feel much. But the second day, he sucked his teeth. It didn't work. They made me sew my bullet wound up and nurse myself, he said. Not long after, they sent him on another job, to the nightclub in Monterey. But he couldn't do it. He couldn't kill any more. He had had enough. I was tired of that lifestyle, he says. I wanted to be left alone. That, he says, is the reason why they turned on him. He wouldn't say how he got away from the throat cutters. Even after he was arrested, he doesn't seem to have boasted about that. Nobody knows what went on, he said. Nobody knows. I had to fight for my life. I'm not going to let anybody kill me. But what could he do then? He knew that in Mexico, the Zetas would find him sooner or later, and they would do to him precisely what he had done to so many people over the preceding 3 years. So he called the American police in Laredo and said he had information for them. He was back in the United States within 48 hours. I didn't want to die. I didn't want my family to die for a mistake that was made when I was 13 years old, he says. I didn't get caught. I turned myself in. Ain't nobody caught me. No cops went to arrest me. I turned myself in. I just wanted all of this to stop. I don't want to live that life anymore. I couldn't keep on going like that. He made the right call. Years later, as court evidence, Rosalia would see the pictures of what Trevino's men did to his best friend Jesse, not long after Rosalio fled. Holes everywhere. He got stabbed all over the place. Neck, head, face, chest, arms, all over his neck, face, and he had a hole right here in his head. Rosalio looked genuinely moved when he described the images, perhaps for the first time in our conversation. He was still a human being, he says. He was still my brother. Rosalio is now serving 2 consecutive life sentences in a prison camp in rural Texas for killings he carried out on that side of the border. He will be released when he is in his 80s, if he lives that long. It is unlikely. After I passed through the barbed wire and metal detectors to see him, the prison guard told me cheerfully that there would be nothing for them, the Zetas, to be able to reach out and put a hit on him inside prison. A year before I met him, 2 other prisoners seized Rosalio and stabbed him 3 times in the back and once in the head. He showed me the scars. His body, I realize now, has a complex topography, where each wound or mess of scar tissue marks a different part of his life. His ripped flesh is a history of the drug war all by itself. He believes they tried to kill him because one of his victims was a member of their prison gang, and so they are obliged to avenge him. Now, for his own safety, he lives in administrative segregation. The guard tells me it's kind of like solitary, except we don't call it solitary. Rosalio explained, "You're in a room 24/7, can't go anywhere. There's nothing I can do. Just in a single cell, by yourself. I've been like that for a year already." He can't make phone calls or talk to anyone. The way I'm treated right now, sometimes I think I should have let them kill me, he said. He will probably live like this for the rest of his life, entombed from the rest of humanity. He is convinced the cartels could kill his family now. His family, and anyone who comes into contact with him. What makes you think they're not going to get you? He said, peering at me. You want to sit here and say what they can't do? They can do anything they want. You don't know the reach people got. You don't know what kind of contacts they got. You don't know who they got on the payroll. You haven't lived that life. I have. I know what these people are capable of doing. I know how far they'll go just to kill somebody. I live that life, not you. He thinks obsessively about that day, when he was 13, and made that decision to pull that trigger. He will freely admit to and discuss almost everything he did for the Zetas, but he spends more than 4 hours trying to convince me, in a pleading, pained voice, that his account of that moment is true, and he was forced. I realize now I should have told him. It's not that moment that sealed your fate. It's the moment when the drug war was launched, long ago. I don't know if he would have understood. Clearly, Rosalio was a disturbed adolescent and would have been whatever our drug policies. But it was the war for drugs that took his adolescent disturbance and gave him huge cash incentives to cultivate it, enlarge it, and live off it. It said, "Murder, and we will shower you with money and cars and women." It gave him paramilitary training to carry out those murders as efficiently as possible, and it hollowed out the Mexican police force so he could continue those murders without fear of arrest. "Everybody around me is dead now," Rosalio said to me, less, I think, in a tone of self-pity than of shock. "Everybody I used to hang around with, they're all dead. There's not even a handful of us that are alive." A few months after I met Rosalio, when I was back in New York, it was reported in the international press that Miguel Treviño had risen, through slaughter, to become number one in the Zetas. And then, a few months after that, it was reported that Miguel Treviño had been captured by the Mexican police in Nuevo Laredo, almost certainly because they were paid by a rival drug gang to take him out. Nobody doubts that another gangster now controls the routes through Mexico into the United States, and nobody doubts he has a fresh batch of expendable child soldiers to defend him. Chapter 10. Marisela's Long March. Rosalio's story was so gruesome that I was sure it couldn't possibly capture the day-to-day life of most Mexicans in the middle of the drug war. He was, as he says, a soldier. Soldiers take part in violence. I kept asking myself, what is life like for the non-combatants? What is normal life like? All these people I could see buying burgers in Wendy's and flat-screen TVs in the mall in Juarez, clearly they weren't working for the Zetas. I wanted to know how living in the middle of all this killing affected them. As I talked to people all over Juarez, I slowly began to glimpse the answer, but it really became clear to me only when I began to investigate a story of a girl who fell in love and a mother who went looking for her. I learned it, as will become clear as the story progresses, by tracking down the people who knew them, and by reading through the records from the time. At first, this will seem like it is a story from a different book, because it focuses on people who have nothing to do with drugs or drug dealing, but in fact it is the closest I came, and the closest, I believe, that I can bring you, to understanding how the drug war has reshaped the psyche of Mexico and the many other countries on the supply route. Rubí Fraire was on a vacation with her big Mexican family in Jalisco. They all stopped off in a diner where the roof was made of palm leaves and a sleepy river rolled past. She was 11 years old. A sarcastic,